Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and these are your virtual coffee chats with military veterans about their civilian career. Today is episode number 287 with, back for a second time, Jan Rutherford.
You know, our development is our own personal responsibility, and the best tool is, you know, to capture your thoughts and, you know, whether it's something you learned or, you know, or whether it's about you or about other people, but starting to capture that. And over time, you can review those and look for patterns.
Well, this is my second interview with Jan. And if you haven't had a chance to listen to episode 240, be sure to check that out. In this interview, we talk about crucible experiences, what they are, why they are so valuable, and steps you can take to introduce them into your everyday life. We talk about why you may want to write a book, even if you don't think you would like to write a book. We talk about self-publishing versus publishing, costs associated with writing a book, and tactical advice on how to make it a success. We also talk about entrepreneurship, life, and a whole lot more. As always, at beyonduniform.org, you'll find show notes with links to everything we discuss, as well as a text transcript thanks to Kathleen Dillon. Special thanks to Dale Ferrand, who back in September wrote on iTunes, singularly best resource during my transition. I explored many, many programs and opportunities for veterans during my transition, and I can say that Justin's podcast was the singular best resource. It broadened my view of what was possible, changed the way I think, and made me comfortable with where I ended up, knowing I had thoroughly explored my options. I recommend this to every transitioning vet and many who have made the transition. Thanks. Thank you, Dale. What a fantastic review. Special thanks to all 112 of you who've left similarly positive reviews on Apple Podcasts. So with that, let's dive in to my conversation with Jan. Well, joining me today, back for a second time, I think one of only two people I've had on the show twice, and I knew at the end of our last conversation this would not be the end. My guest today in Portland, Oregon, is Jan Rutherford. Jan, welcome back to Beyond the Uniform.
Hey, Justin, thank you. And it was so great meeting you in person last time I was in Denver.
Yeah, for those of you who listened to, I guess it would have been my April 28th, sneak peek of the month of May. I told you guys about my coffee with Jan. I even relayed a video tip that I'm in the midst of going, or a resource tip that I'm going through around values work. So hopefully some of you listen to that episode and check that out. But yeah, it was great meeting with you in person. And you're one of those people who's always kind of pushing the frontier on things. So it's always great to get the download of what you're thinking about and what you're doing.
Yeah, thanks. It's really a pleasure to be on the show.
So for listeners, we're going to go just straight in. If you have not listened to episode 240, it'll be linked in the show notes. Definitely worth checking that out either before this one or in addition to it. In that episode, we dig into a ton of great stuff, but we had a lot of ground uncovered. At least right now, the plan is we're going to talk about Jan's process of writing a book, stories from the crucibles, how to create crucible experiences, his podcast, and his advice on starting a company. Who knows? We may ditch that if more fertile ground is found. But for listeners, that's the quick roadmap. So Jan, maybe let's start off with tell us about the book that you wrote. And then I'd love to dive into the process of writing a book for listeners who may aspire to do that.
Yeah. So the book is called The Littlest Green Beret on Self-Reliant Leadership. And there's a picture on the front of me when I got my Green Beret and I, you know, weighed 114 pounds and, you know, the skinny young teenager. And I, as soon as I saw the picture way back when, I thought, you know, if I ever write a book, I'm going to put that on the front because all these people said I wouldn't be able to become a Green Beret and I'm going to show them. So, you know, that it literally, I thought of the book way back then that someday I'd like to write about my story and about leadership and team. And I collected notes for years and years and had these ideas and, you know, talked about it. But it wasn't until, and I remember October 2006, on the way to Maui on a business trip, I started writing it. And I was so excited. And so from October 2006 to when it was published, March 2011. Almost 4.5 years.
Wow.
The book done. And when I looked at it, I did the math and I said, geez, if I had written 500 words a day I could have gotten the book done in 6 months. But it doesn't work that way. I could write 500 words super easy, but it would be disjointed. It wouldn't come together and be what I would call threaded. So I had an editor that didn't last the whole time because she was helpful and then she wasn't. And then I had somebody that came along that was the editor and the publisher, and they were really helpful in helping me tie it together, because I would write something, and I'd go, well, these are disjointed. They don't flow. They don't come together. And finally I had somebody help. And what's interesting is it took 4 years. I couldn't have rushed it. It took that long because, unlike an article or a blog, a book is something that you think about all the time and how it's going to come together and your deepest thoughts, and really trying to figure out how honest I wanted to be in it too. You know, and I kind of went back to a Harry Chapin quote in a song he wrote, you know, don't write about the things write about your feelings, not the things you never did. And I remember, you know, saying, hey, if you're going to be a real writer, you got to be courageous and you got to write things that are painful and things you don't want to necessarily say. And then I thought about, well, how much of this that I'm writing about leadership is really evidence-based versus just anecdotal? So I was, when I hit send, I was not done with the book, but I went, at some point I've got to ship, and I hit send. And if I wrote the book today, it would probably be very similar, but in some ways it would be very different. But anyway, that's a long story about
This is great. I want to get a little bit tactical on this. So one question I have is, if you were doing this over again today, you talked about, you know, you were taking notes for years. If you were doing it over again today, how would you keep track of those notes? Was that in a physical notebook or Evernote, or how do you keep that all together?
Well, Evernote didn't exist when I started my career. The notes were all over the place. I had articles I'd highlighted. I had books, you know, I highlighted. I had notes and I had journals. I mean, my desk at the time was just covered, you know, as I was kind of doing research. And what I would do today differently is spend more time on the outline. Of course I had an outline, but I would spend more time on the outline and really, from a pedagogical perspective, saying, you know, what's the beginning of this chapter, the middle and the end? What's the story? What's the case? What are these takeaway? And then filled it in later. A lot of the way I wrote in this first book, I would just start writing. I'd start writing and then I'd try to thread it together. That was sort of my process, and that's what would have changed now.
You talked about that it sounds like an editor didn't really work out. If you were starting over again today, what advice do you have for listeners about how to find an editor and how to kick the tires on them and understand if they're the good, right fit for you?
Well, if they've edited a book that's similar to what you're writing. Mm-hmm. So in my experience, there's two kinds of editors. There's editors that can check your grammar, spelling, punctuation. And then there's editors that actually understand the audience. A good editor will ask, you know, like a good publisher, they'll ask, well, who's the audience? What are you trying to convey? What's your hypothesis? What do you hope they get out of this? How big's that audience? What do they look like? What, you know, the age, the, you know, the whole demographics. That's the sign of an editor that really knows it's all about the audience. You know, there's a lot of people out there that can, you know, check your spelling, punctuation, but they're going to miss, you know, when you're looking for those things, you miss the overall big picture of what you're trying to convey.
It's so interesting, because I'm thinking of this in terms of product management and of marketing. And in both of those cases, you have, you know, called various things, but I'll just call it an ideal customer persona, where you create this fictitious representation of who you're building a product for or who you are marketing to, so you can understand more about them and their needs and what they read and where they visit. And so it's interesting, like, that stretches over to writing as well, which makes sense. Like the outline and the audience makes sense. But I also know that my tendency, and I think a lot of veterans, our tendency is just to dive in.
Yep.
And that can lead to things being more difficult than necessary.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, to the veterans listening out there, you know, one of the things about writing a book is that you spent time, you sacrifice, you devote, you know, devoted time, and forever you have a really, really substantial business card. It gives you a certain amount of credibility. If you don't have proclivity to write a book, I still encourage you to write, to develop your, you know, thoughts and put things out there. If I were hiring somebody these days and they said they were an expert in some area, the first thing I would do is go to LinkedIn and look, you know, have they written articles? I mean, or are they just reposting things other people have written? Or, but are they putting out there, hey, here's what I'm learning in my work. Here's observations I've made. Here's ahas that I have. Let me put those out there and kind of test it. That's what I would encourage, you know, the people that are listening that are, you know, have a certain amount of professional and career aspiration and ambition to do that. And again, it does take a certain amount of courage, because the first time you put your writing out there, and no matter who you are, you think, I'm not that great of a writer. I'm kind of, and now, you know, I'm at a point where, hey, I'm an okay writer. I'm not a great writer, but I have things to say and I know people will respond. And it's interesting to me when I put things out there to see, you know, which things get the biggest response. That's always fascinating.
And for listeners, because I'm trying to write more, I know that that's difficult to do. I just I did this research project, and one of the apps I uncovered in doing this was an app called Day One Journal. And today is day two for me with Day One Journal, but I'll put it in the show notes. It's designed obviously around journaling, but it's designed to be, and they've gotten a lot of awards for being as simple as possible for writing, recognizing how difficult it is for all of us to write, and also how difficult it is to actually reflect upon what we've written previously. And so if you're getting energized about what Jan's talking about and you want to practice more, I'd invite you to join me in doing day one, using that as a journal and just trying to get those thoughts out there. I think that, you know, I think there's a lot of research that shows that journaling and writing is a really powerful way to structure your thinking and to also vent a lot of feelings and emotions. And one of the intentions for me in writing more is, you know, I feel like I spend a lot of time, like on this interview, listening to other people, and I don't make the time to listen to myself. And journaling is one tool to actually kind of get your thoughts out physically and to see them. And I was surprised this morning, like I was thinking through a couple business and then personal things that I'm trying to grapple with. And in each of those, as I started to write, it was almost like I could see my thoughts starting to come out. I could see all these things that are just really difficult to analyze when they're in your head, but once they're in front of you in writing, it's like, oh, I feel like I'm making progress on these.
Yeah. Well, we give this card to the people that participate in our crucible expeditions, and we set aside 4 hours at some point. It doesn't sound like much time for what we call the solo challenge. Mm-hmm. And we give them this card in a little journal, and it just has a couple things here. You know, what did you learn today? What are you grateful for? Rate the day on a scale 1 to 10. And what's the one priority for tomorrow? Hmm. So it could be 4 sentences. And I just remember when I was a young lieutenant, we had a professional development session, and this guy came in, retired colonel. And he said, if you remember nothing else from my talk today, remember this: all great men have kept journals. And I thought, well, I want to be a great man. I should keep a journal. And as a professional coach, I can tell you that, you know, our development is our own personal responsibility. And the best tool is, you know, to capture your thoughts. And, you know, whether it's something you learned or, you know, or whether it's about you or about other people, but starting to capture that. And over time, you can review those and look for patterns.
What I think is so awesome about that quote is, I love the psychological hack that seems to be, in a good way, of like, you know, when I think of Roosevelt, when I think of Eisenhower, when I think of Steve Jobs, when I think of these like epic human beings, it's like, of course they have journals. Of course I would want to learn about these people. But then when I start to journal, it's almost like saying, hey, I aspire to achieve great things. I aspire to do great things in my life. And great people keep journals. Like there's this great subtlety there of when you're starting to journal, like reinforcing that you're aspiring to greatness.
Yeah. Well, what's really cool is for me, you know, the best thing about my journals is I captured a lot of the things my kids said when they were young in there. And, you know, there's 30, you know, years of notes from that, that one day they say, you know, they'll be able to read. But they always joke, Dad, nobody can read your handwriting. Because I didn't keep it on the computer. I kept it in, you know, leather-bound journals. But I have all that, you know, as a historical record of, you know, little goofy things they said and things we did and vacations we took, along with tons of work stuff. So it's all in there.
That's great. Yeah, I love the physical act of writing on paper. I think it's even more. I was actually doing something this morning over breakfast on my own, and the guy serving was like, "Oh, it's so great to see someone writing something physically."
Yeah.
And I know I'm the same way. My writing is so atrocious that it's like that's one of the reasons I'm trying to do this now on computer, is just making it more efficient and also being able to use the search functionality to find stuff. But I love that idea of having these little quotes from your kids and just all the things that you want to remember. Yeah. I also wanted to ask you one other question on writing is, what advice do you have for listeners about whether to self-publish or whether to pursue a publisher?
Yeah. Well, self-publishing these days is easy. And you go through no middleman, which is great. One thing to keep in mind for 99.9% of people that write a book is you will not make money off the book. You know, you'll make a certain amount of royalties, but it's not enough to really do anything. Even people that have been on the New York Times bestselling list, chances are they didn't make a substantial amount of money. It went to the New York Times bestselling list for a day or something. From that perspective, I mean, you can self-publish. I think there's a certain esteem to getting published by a big publisher. I didn't. But even the big publishers, unless you're, you know, Dan Brown or somebody like that, you're going to do all the marketing yourself, no matter what. Nobody's going to put a ton of money and a ton of effort behind it. You have to market the book yourself. And, you know, part of if you're going to write a book is to decide, why am I writing it? When I wrote mine, it was for me and it was for my kids. And it was basically to, you know, establish credibility as a potential speaker. It was in that order for me, for the kids, and to establish my credibility. And it's done all those things. I wouldn't have had the opportunities I've had to speak and do workshops and to be an executive coach if I didn't have the credibility of having written one.
I think that's great. I'm a big fan of, I'm trying more in my life before I do things to set out an intention, just to kind of know, like, why am I having this conversation? Why am I doing this thing? And so I love the example you gave there. And I think those are great. Like, first of all, it's probably not going to be a source of revenue or a significant source of revenue, but having that for your children and family for posterity, and then establishing credibility. I've had other guests on the show who talk about that, where if you aspire to be a speaker, if you aspire to have some sort of online persona, it gives you a tremendous amount of credibility. And one of the interviews I did recently with Lita Citrion had talked about that. Yeah, she said, look, whenever I go to speak, the first question they ask is, what's your, you know, where's your book? And and she has that now. And it kind of checks the box in credibility and saying that I have expertise in this area. One other just kind of really, oh, there we go. And for listeners, The Littlest Green Beret, we're going to have links to that on Amazon in the show notes if you want to check that out. One other question I had is, especially if you go the self-publishing route, can you give us a sense of costs to anticipate? Because you talked about working with an editor, and I'm guessing that's going to be costing a certain amount. How much money should they set aside, and what does that roughly go to?
Gosh. And I did sort of a mix. I used a publisher, but it was a very small publisher. And so I did all the marketing. But to this day, I mean, when I need books, I go through my publisher and he mails me a box of books and I have to pay for them and all that. You know, what it, gosh, what it cost at the beginning. I mean, you know, I paid for some things and, you know, the publisher paid for some things. But it was not substantial. But on the royalty side, and again, I don't know what it is, but, you know, my book costs $12 and half the profit from the book goes to the Special Operations Warrior Foundation or the Green Beret Foundation. So if I make anything off a book, it's probably $1 or $2. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that just goes to, you know, a lot of the work I do to help veterans on the expeditions. And these days, you know, it's been 8 years since a book was published. I probably give away more books than I sell. You know, I'll go to a speaking event or a workshop or, and I'll just give them away. You know, the business is doing pretty well. I can afford to do that. And that's pretty nice. But honestly, Justin, I couldn't tell you the price on those things. I would tell you whatever it is, your return is going to be greater, way greater.
And I love, you know, I'm starting as someone who is always fixated on the destination, not the journey. I'm trying to shift that, but I'm realizing, let's say with journaling, when I journal, yes, of course, this can be used for me to reflect in the future, but just the physical act of journaling does something good for my mental well-being. Mm-hmm. And I imagine it's the same for the process of writing the book, is that yes, of course, at the end you have this output, but the journey in getting there of having to express yourself and get your knowledge out on paper, that's worth it in and of itself. And then there's all these other additional benefits around branding and expertise and things like that.
Yeah. And I would say if you even think you want to write a book, tell everybody you're going to write a book and tell them when the book's coming out. And those people will nudge you till the cows come home. And that'll be good for you. Cause excuse me, there's 2 or 3 times in those 4.5 years when I started and when I finished that I didn't write a single thing. I mean, work just consumed me and I couldn't write when I was exhausted, you know, mentally, physically, or emotionally. I had to write when I was fresh. And most of the time, the fresh part of the day, it was, you know, going to work and doing other things. So, but I had all these people I had told I'm writing a book asking me, when's it coming out? Where are you at? And that whole guilt thing behind you. And knowing, you know, hey, what if something happened to me and I didn't get this thing finished? You know, one of the coolest things when my grandkids were born, when my grandson was born, there is a, my daughter took a picture of him. He was like, I don't know, 1.5 years old. And he was laying on his back and he had my book and he was looking in the middle of my book are pictures. And he was looking at my book and like, that's cool.
That's awesome.
You know, that, you know, I don't know anything about my great grandparents and beyond. I really don't. And, you know, it's kind of nice to think, you know, hey, when I'm long gone, you know, somebody, I mean, that book's still going to be here and somebody will be able to look at that and that know a little bit of the family history and what I, you know, what I went through and maybe somebody that's not even born yet down the road will say, oh, that's where I get that.
I love that. I love that. Yeah. I think of that too, of my grandparents and great grandparents. I'm like at that age that I think we all come to where there's more curiosity of understanding that and wanting to know where we came from and what a great contribution to future generations to be able to look back on that.
Yeah.
I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about Crucible experiences. And for listeners, Jan is the founder of Self-Reliant Leadership. That's an executive and military veteran program for leaders who are selfless, adventurous, and possess heroic aspirations. Can you share with us the two things I'd love to cover in some way is just any examples of these Crucible experiences?
Yeah.
And even more importantly, ideally, listeners can join you on one of these crucibles, but to make it actionable, are there ways for listeners to create their own crucible or mini crucible experience?
Yeah, great questions. Every year, at the beginning of the year, we start to get veteran applicants that are interested, and then in February, we select veterans to participate. And and what we're doing in the fall is recruiting executives who, through their fee, subsidize the veterans. This year we're doing three crucibles. We're doing Alaska, Colorado, and Moab, Utah. Actually, this week it will be Moab. And it's half veteran, half execs, and we pair one executive with one veteran. And again, the executives are trying to digital detox, slow down to speed up, step back away from the business. And the military veterans are at a point where they're trying to reestablish, you know, the next chapter in the business world or the nonprofit or leading in some way outside the government. So that's the whole idea. And it is character based, and it is about team. And it is the whole time we're out there is translating the lessons out in the wilderness to the business world. And the whole idea of, you know, creating your own crucible, what if you can't go on one of our expeditions, was the topic of my TED talk last year. And that is, you know, ultimately a crucible is a severe test in which people are shaped into something indomitable. And we know from Bill George's work on authentic leadership that the thing that leaders have in common amongst all other things is they're constantly testing themselves, a crucible. And if you're constantly testing yourself, chances are you're constantly failing. You're not going to pass every test every time. And are you willing to be bold and adventurous and put yourself out there and be vulnerable? And because that's where growth and learning come from. So as you're looking at things, whether it's writing a book or taking on a new career, to think big. You know, to think beyond that. You know, one of the terms that was coined on our Patagonia crucible by a special operations guy was, he said, "We're at the Poner." I'm like, "Poner?" It's a point of no return. You know, it's 3 days that way, 3 days that way, too windy for choppers. Anybody gets hurt, we're screwed. And, you know, that night, all of us talked about, gosh, we all need poners in our life, point of no return. Like, you know, failure is not an option. There's no coming back. I'm going to quit the job I hate and with no backup plan, whatever it is. How bold are we being? And, you know, are we living, you know, a life that we're proud of, or are we settling? You know, all of us, you know, want to make a difference. We all feel like we were put on this earth for a reason. And that reason ultimately is to serve other people in some way, shape, or form. That's what work is. Work is serving others. It's for the benefit of other people. I mean, if you write a book, it might be for yourself, but you're putting it out there, hopefully, to help other people. So anyway, that's the whole basis of the crucible. And again, when you're a little cold, wet, tired, and uncomfortable, it changes you. Mm. And, you know, hopefully for the better. And that's what I would urge people listening is, if, you know, if you're in that zone of comfort, you know that nothing's going to change in your zone of comfort. Mm-hmm. Only when you step out of it are things going to change, you know, and make forward progress.
I love that. I love so much of what you're saying. The audiobook I'm listening to right now that I would recommend to listeners is Can't Hurt Me by David Goggins, mm-hmm. who is a Navy SEAL ultra runner and just incredibly hard human being. Yeah. And what I appreciate about his perspective is his vantage point is that we're all, you know, operating at 40% of our capacity. And mm-hmm. the only way, you know, as I interpret it, the only way to push past that is to put yourself in situations where you hit your limit and have to go beyond it. And he does that through running 100 miles. He'd never run more than like 20 miles in his life, and then did an ultra marathon, which I wouldn't advise, but that's one of the examples he does. And so, and I think that there's little ways to do that too. Like one that I'm experimenting with right now, I love my hot showers, but I'm trying at the end, the final minute of my shower, to crank it on the coldest water possible and just be, you know, be there in cold water, which is not something I enjoy. Mm. And I agree with Jan that like all of the growth, all the juice, all the good stuff comes when we are out of our comfort zone, when we are scared. And I, any advice to people on different ways to play around with this in their life?
Yeah. Well, again, I think it goes back to, you know, what you mentioned at the very beginning is understanding what you value. You know, what do you hold dear? What's important in your life? And then start to examine, are you moving toward those things or away from them? And chances are, if you're moving toward those, you know, it'll scare you. You know, one of the often quoted coaching questions is to ask somebody, you know, what would you do if it was impossible to fail? Hmm. I mean, you know, that's a tough question. You know, if what would I do if I knew I wouldn't fail? Well, why aren't you doing that? Or moving in that direction? And again, you know, the people listening to this show, I mean, if you're listening, you know, to podcasts, you're somebody that's probably all about, trying to make yourself better, to learn something, to push yourself. You know, one of the questions I ultimately would ask, not just what your values are and are you moving toward them, but kind of going back to, for whose good do you serve? You know, who are your people? And what are you doing to make that community better? You know, if you're all about the outdoor and adventure, you know, then your people are people that are, you know, in Colorado and fit and those kind of people. It might be you're more on the IT side of things. But really understanding, you know, who are your people and are you serving them in the best way that you're capable and not limiting yourself to, you know, small goals. You know, a really great guy in Denver once asked me, Jan, are you playing big ball or small ball? And it's a really good question because it basically says, you know, are you settling? And again, I mean, there's people out there that say, hey, I want to have a lifestyle business and this is the kind of life I want to have and comfortable and I don't want to push myself. And if that's you, then that's fine. If you're somebody that's, you know, there's something kind of gnawing at you a little bit that you think you can push, then, you know, looking at your values, looking at for whose good do you serve, and then also looking at how you're investing your time or spending your time is important. Because that's all we got, you know. We got 24 hours a day to get stuff done, and of that 24, we probably only got about 12.
I really like that, and there's this sense that we had, and I know I shared this with listeners on that Saturday episode, but there is something about taking the time to do the heavy lifting. And I remember you shared with me your three values, but really being crisp. And you walked me through this process that I interpreted as starting with a longer list of values and then really having to prioritize and eliminate them. And in this brutal battle royale at the end, three values remain. And this
right.
hours, you know, that I interpret it to take to really get that crystal clear, but that allows you then to say yes and no to things. It allows you to make sure that you're living in alignment with where you want to go. And mm-hmm. I love this thought too of getting out of the jacuzzi and getting out of where it's warm and comfortable. I do a lot of consulting work right now, and when I take on projects, there's an element where I'm trying to take on projects that scare me and where I'm not sure if I can deliver, because I know that's going to force me to grow in to the person that can solve those problems. And so it's just one example of trying to take on things that can be physical as well, like signing up for a race where you don't know if you can finish. I guarantee you, you're going to train more that way. I guarantee you, you're going to work harder and you're going to become a better person through the process rather than signing up for the 5K or the 1 mile or whatever it is for you that you know you could do without preparing.
Yep. Yeah. Well, that's, again, it's constantly testing yourself.
Yep.
That's, you know, that's what Bill George found that leaders have in common, you know, whether they're 23 or 93, they're constantly testing themselves. And again, you don't test yourself in your zone of comfort. So yeah, it's good stuff. Really, it's really good. And I'm glad you added in, you know, it's not just about physical things. You know, it might be a job where, you know, some of us, there's times in your life where you might think, you know, you get the imposter syndrome. Like, what the heck am I doing here? These guys all think I know. I mean, you know, who am I fooling? I mean, if you don't go through that at some point in your life, I would say you're not pushing yourself.
That's great. It's just interesting to think about too, because I think the side of me from the military, there's still this fear of failure. There's still this thought that like failure is catastrophic or can bring about death or destruction of massive amounts of equipment. And it's trying to reprogram oneself to realize like, hey, you know, if I fail on a consulting project, maybe I get a bad review or I don't make as much money. That's not catastrophic. That's something I can live with. But the upside of growing and becoming better and pushing myself is worth it.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you, gosh, you know, I've had a whole career and I'm still have a career, and I've had plenty of failures, and it's not those, you know, not all the failures were a long time ago. You know, some of them were recent, and you know, what I've had to learn, and maybe this will be helpful to the listeners, to some listeners, is, you know, it's easy to ruminate on failures. It's easy to have that going, you know, on a loop in your head and beating yourself up. And I think, you know, when we talk about resilience and get, you know, bouncing back and getting up from the fight, it's literally deciding I have to change, you know, I have to change the playlist in my head. If I keep doing this, it is destructive. I've got to put that, you know, behind me and move on. And to me, you know, that's resilience, not the physical part, you know, but I mean, mental resilience. And again, those failures, those things that we beat ourselves up about are the things that I think lead to wisdom. Cause it's like you learned a lesson the really hard way and it was painful. Mm. But most of us don't learn the really great lessons without a certain amount of pain and failure. I mean, when we succeed and things are easy, you know, we're, you know, high five, and we're not reflecting and ruminating and figuring out where did, you know, why did I succeed? We're just celebrating it. Whereas when we fail, we really examine it. But I think once we've done that, we need to move forward.
Mm. It's interesting too, because it's like, I just love the analogy with weightlifting, where you're tearing muscle and it's rebuilding stronger. And so it's the reps that get you better. And when you talk about recovering from failure, there's this like ugh inside me where it's like, oh man, I know the only way for me to become more resilient, or one of the primary ways for me to become more resilient and better at recovering from failure, is to fail more often and to get into that habit of like, can I get back up? And I, you know, I always think of things in terms of marriage with my wife, Rebecca. It's like, you know, we've put a lot of effort into our relationship, and we've gone to workshops and we've gone to therapy and all these different things. And I, the sign of success that I see is like, you know, we used to have an argument years ago and it would take a week for us to reconnect. And then there was a point at which I was like, wow, we reconnected in 3 days. That's a massive improvement. You know, and it's like, that's kind of what it is it's like making mistakes. And can you get back up a little bit faster? Can you make maybe a 10% improvement? Can you fail at a race and redo it? And there's the, you know, the theoretical side that's just easy to nod my head, but the reality of what you're talking about is brutal, like getting these scars and these wounds and then still coming back.
Yeah. Mm. Hey, for a guy that's been married 35 years, I'll tell you, you know, what's worked for me.
Yeah.
You ready?
Mm-hmm.
You're right. I'm wrong. I don't deserve you.
I'm writing that down as we talk.
Yeah, that'll save you a lot of time and money. And in my case, it's right. It's correct, because my wife is like Mary Poppins. She's practically perfect.
That's awesome.
And I'm not being sarcastic. I hit the lottery. Hmm. But again, I mean, she's right. I'm wrong, and I truly don't deserve her. And you know, being quick to admit your mistakes, whether it's in marriage or in leadership, you know, I think that's an important part of humility. I mean, you know, the fact that you don't have to be right, you know, your pride's not getting in the way.
I love it. Well, I know that we're nearing the end of our time, but you've also had a really incredible career as an entrepreneur. And for listeners, if you listen to the previous episode, in episode 240, you'll hear about all the work that Jan did before he started his own company and all the expertise and skill he built up before he became an entrepreneur. But I'm wondering if you have any advice to listeners about starting their own company.
Yeah. Well, I'm still learning, but I'll say this. you can do analysis paralysis till the cows come home. But I think the best analysis or the best marketing research is to go out and sell. And sell, for some of you, might sound like a dirty word, you know, but if you're going to be a great entrepreneur, you've got to be a great salesperson. And that, it doesn't mean you have to be slick. It means you have to go out there with a passion to believe your vision is going to help people. And to get out there and start talking to people and putting your offering in front of people, you're going to get feedback on what works, what doesn't. That's going to best inform whether you've got a great idea. You know, sitting there and writing a perfect business plan just doesn't cut it. Because at the end of the day, the successful entrepreneurs are the people that really know their market. You know, the most successful VC I've ever met, a guy out of Ireland, said, you know, the people that get in front of him and get money are people that sell the problem, not the product. Sell the problem. And the problem is, what's going on in the market that needs your help? Well, the best way to figure that out is to get out there and start talking to the market, not sitting in a room and, you know, writing a perfect 20-page business plan that you're going to get in front of people. Just go do it.
For listeners, if you look in the show notes, I'll put a link to Sarah Ford, who was on the show recently. She's the founder of a company called Ranch Road Boots. And I'll a little bit butcher the quote, but what the advice she was given when she was starting the company was, if you want to see if this company is worthwhile, go sell 50 boots. Like, don't business plan this, don't focus group this. If you can sell 50 boots, you can get to 1,000. And what I love about that is not just the focus on action towards learning in the real world, but also the thought that she was generating money by doing that. And that's a lot better than, you know, in my opinion, a lot of times trying to get funding before you have an actual product and all these other things. So I love that bias towards action that Jan's talking about, of not, you know, if you're one of those people who has the bias to just sit in a room forever and plan, to just put the rubber to the road and see if you can actually, if you can find that problem, if you can sell that problem.
Yep.
Well, Jan, thank you for coming back a second. Oh, go ahead.
No, thank you, Justin. Yeah. It's been a pleasure. I hope, you know, our conversation has provided value to the listeners out there. And I welcome anyone getting in touch with me and to learn more about my work and ways that I can steer people in the right direction to help them.
Could you, I know we didn't have a ton of time to go into it, but could you give the 60 seconds on your podcast? Because you've got some incredible guests that you've had on the show, and I want to make sure that listeners are aware of that as a resource.
Yeah, thanks. Our podcast is theleadershippodcast.com, and we're on social media at We Study Leaders. So either of those. And the people we've had, you know, for those of you veterans out there, we've had General Stanley McChrystal, we've had Sebastian Younger, we've had Dan Pink, Ori Brofman, we've had the head of Cyber Command and National Security Agency, you know, just some amazing people. And the whole idea is we study leaders. We just want to understand what makes leadership happen and how we can be more effective at making teams come together. Because as we're talking about entrepreneurship here, Justin, if your vision and your goals are big enough, then that means you can't do it by yourself. That you have to be inspirational to others, aka leadership, to get other people to buy into that leader, to that vision, to that purpose, to help execute. And you know, beyond what you're all about, you're going to need other people to help you. And I can tell you, as an entrepreneur, I might not have 400 employees. I have mostly contract people that work with me. But if I look around at my team of people that I consider my team, my partners, you know, some of the people I pay, some of the people, you know, I don't, it's about 40 or 50 people that are in the orbit of self-reliant leadership that make this whole thing run. And for that, I'm so grateful.
Well, that's awesome. For listeners, I'm going to add in the show notes a links to the Leadership Podcast, to the Littlest Green Beret. And also, you know, the way that I got to Jan was through an interview that I did ages ago. It doesn't feel like ages ago, but back in episode 216 with Kimberly Young, She told me about her experience going on one of these self-reliant leadership experiences. And especially for those of you who are on active duty or may have transitioned recently, what a great way to both push yourself, but also gain exposure to half of a group, which is civilian leaders, and have a different perspective than you, and you can learn from each other. And so check out episode 216 and 240 if you want to learn more about that. And I'll have links to the Self-Reliant Leadership website as well, where you can figure out their schedule and maybe end up at Patagonia, Moab, or in some of these crazy cool locations. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Quick couple admin points. We release brand new episodes every single Monday and Thursday. Those are usually recorded about a month or so before they go live. Every Monday and Thursday, we have an interview, usually almost always with a military veteran about their civilian career. More and more, we're starting to add in experts who may not be veterans, but may have some expertise that will help the military veteran community. Saturdays, I typically post more of a behind the scenes episode, which is a free form format. I try to use what I'm calling a mullet format. And by that, I mean business up front, party in the back, talking through admin points, professional topics related to the podcast. It might be a conversation I had that week. It might have been an interview I had that week, but just trying to share things that are top of mind that may help you in more of a free form, straight from the heart format. And then the party in the back is the personal side of things, just kind of more free flowing thoughts on life, on improving oneself, just kind of whatever's going on in life and trying to be authentic and honest about those things as well. Special thanks. We have an all volunteer army of people behind Beyond the Uniform making this possible. We do this on our lunch breaks, on our evenings, on our weekends, because we love the military community. We want to give back. We want to make a difference. We want that as part of the purpose in our life that we valued in the military. So special thanks to Steve Bain. Steve does pretty much everything. He helps secure guests. He does our newsletter. He keeps the reels rolling and keeps me sane. Kathleen Dillon, the first person to join our team. She writes text transcripts of every single episode. It's wild. She keeps up with two of these a week, despite a demanding career and education right now. But those transcripts help us get more SEO value, helps her audience more. Andrew Woolridge is our data guru. He helps us understand the numbers, which is the easiest way for us to figure out how we can better support you, and adds kind of the data oversight for that. Rick Healy does all of our social media. He is gaining more and more of an audience for us by getting our videos, getting our podcasts out on social channels. The best way to stay in contact with us is if you go to beyondtheuniform.org, there is a newsletter. You'll have a little pop-up that comes up. You can put your email in. We email twice per month. We try to be respectful, but it is a great way to get appraised of upcoming events, upcoming interviews, promos where companies are giving discounts to Beyond the Uniform listeners, and more. This does cost money to put on. We are committed to not charging veterans directly, and the way that we kind of offset costs is through corporate sponsors. So if you know of a company that would like to get in front of a military audience and their families, that's one way that we can both add value to our members, but also offset the costs of Beyond the Uniform and give us a little bit of budget to start expanding what we're doing. So that's the best way you can help us. If that's not something that you can do, a positive review on iTunes is greatly appreciated. Have a wonderful week. We will be back Monday, Thursday, and Saturday with more interviews. And keep up the listening. Take care.